I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. We are back with another one of our Sunday live streams, streaming out in the afternoon, if you're in the United States, in the evening, if you're listening in Europe, and we have listeners all over the world. We have a truly international, nationalist audience here. If you would like to help out Countercurrents, help us stay on the air, help us make our fundraiser goal, which is necessary to keep us alive and keep us streaming, keep the signal strong, please go to the address on the screen. It's entropystream.live/countercurrents. You can hit the green button and leave a chat, a paid chat, and we will definitely read your chat and thank you in the course of the stream. We are going to be talking about American Krogan's BioShock theory or series, which is on video games. And if you have game-related questions, BioShock especially, or just any gaming questions, this is the guy to talk to. So share us your game, share some gaming questions with us. He will definitely talk them over. And of course, we will talk about current events as well. So we are not going to be simply confined to the BioShock thing, although I'd like to spend a lot of time talking about it. But we are also going to be talking about what you're interested in, including current events, our takes on current events, and big issues, metapolitical issues. So I would like to welcome our two guests. Our guest of honor tonight is American Krogan. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me on again. It's always a privilege and an honor to be on here. So yeah, thanks.
Well, it's a pleasure, and it was way too long. I really enjoyed our last conversation. And joining me, because he's not as old and out of touch as I am, and so I figure he could better relate to to the actual games, is Thomas Steuben. Thomas, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be here. Gamers, rise up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's begin. And what I want to do is I just want to sprint through some people at Entropy who have left us donations. If you go to entropystream.live/countercurrents without the hyphen, it'll say that we're not online and we're not streaming on DLive at the moment, or at Entropy at the moment, but you can hit the green button and you can leave a question, a comment with a donation of $3 or up, and we will be most grateful. So I want to go back a few. Cozy James sends $50, says, love your show. Thank you very much. Dinica's Ghost sends $50 and the message 14. Thank you very much. Steven sends $100. Very, very generous. This is off to a very strong start. I very much appreciate it. And folks, I want you to know that any donations you make in the course of the stream, really any donations that have come in since yesterday afternoon, will be matched. We have a new matching grant in effect. A generous friend has offered to match the next $5,000 that are donated to Countercurrents. So your money will go further. Intractable American has sent $40. Thank you. Vol has sent 10. RC has sent 50 and another 50. That's fantastic. Thank you very much. Michael has sent 135. That's very, very generous. And that'll get you behind the paywall. Definitely. AJ has sent $140. Again, AJ, get signed up for the paywall. Niels has written in with $200. And his message is, I don't recall the amount you had to donate to petition the venerable Jim Goh to sing, but I hope this will suffice. My heart would be gladdened if he were to sing either For Bales or Dixie. I think for $200, he'll sing both, preferably For Bales, but I'm up for whichever. The blessings of the gods upon the men manning the posts at Countercurrents. Last week, we had Jim Goad on the writer's block with Nick Gilvey. And Jim, to help Countercurrents out, has promised to do karaoke versions of songs that people choose if they will make donations to Countercurrents. So I will pass your requests along to Jim, and they will go up on his Karaoke Cavalcade YouTube channel. So thank you very much. I really appreciate it. Neil sends another $50. This is for the writer's block. Most Danes settled in Northumbria, as far as I'm aware, but also East Anglia was heavily Daned. Nevertheless, we settled mostly in the north of England. I will pass that along. Jasper sends in $75 And he says, J.D. Vance, author of Hillbilly Elegy and now U.S. Senate candidate for Ohio, suggested expanding voting privileges to children. That is, he floated the idea of giving parents more votes proportionate to the number of children they have. What do you think of this idea? Is your opinion different for the U.S. versus relatively homogeneous European states? Guys, I'd like to begin by talking about this one because it's a cool question, and then we'll get into BioShock. So if you'll bear with me. J.D. Vance is an interesting guy. He's been making very solid populist nationalist noises. He's certainly outside the mainstream Republican box, and I think he would be definitely a good Republican. He would be better than any mainstream Republican. So my friends in Ohio, I hope you vote for him. I hope he wins. However, that said, this is a bad proposal. In a homogeneous white society, yes, I like the idea of families having votes, the father or the mother, whoever's the head of the household. I mean, sometimes dads die, right? But whoever is the head of the household gets to cast a vote for himself or herself and all the other members of the household, which means that if you have seven kids, you have nine votes. And I think that's a great idea because that gives political power to in greater proportion to people who have an investment in the future. And when your kids grow up and they can vote for themselves, you lose their vote, they gain it, right? That sounds like a very reasonable proposal. It would ensure that you have family-friendly policies, that the people who are exercising political power have a greater stake in the future. However, in a multiracial society like America, where whites have precariously low, below replacement rates of reproduction, and non-whites who are flooding in have above replacement reproduction rates, giving votes out proportional to the number of children they have is basically just going to hasten the great replacement in America. So I think that's a terrible idea. But in the context of a society that's not suffering from race replacement immigration and doesn't have, let's just say, an underclass, an ethnically distinct underclass or two or three that are highly fertile, then that's the kind of thing you would want. But in any other kind of society, a multicultural society with highly fertile outsiders that really you don't want to have more political power, this is just a bad, bad idea. So what do you think about this first, American Krogan?
I agree with pretty much everything you just said. The only thing I can add to that is that there was a study I came across about a year ago when I was doing my series on the Visigoths, and it was about the record of testaments in Spain between the years of 1400 to roughly 1800 thereabouts. And over 85% of males there named their wives as the executor of their estates in their absence or death. And I think this is a really important thing to point out about Europeans in general. Like, this is a very distinct practice from the rest of the world. Most of the rest of the world, in the absence of the patriarch of the family, the authority defers to another male related immediately to that patriarch. And, you know, a lot of our guys today are very upset about feminism and so on and so forth, and rightly so. But we shouldn't go to the extreme where we deny that our sexual dynamics are very distinct from the rest of the world. I don't think, I think that the authority of a family unit deferring to the woman in the absence of the father is perfectly natural in our case. And that's something I would like to see continue.
Okay, that's a good point. Thank you very much. Thomas, what are your thoughts on J.D. Vance's proposal?
After most agree with what you said, I understand where he's coming from because of the possible short-term benefits. For now, we have like literal pedophilia being taught in schools. We have these childless, barren crazy ladies taping masks to children, which to me is child abuse. So by giving head of household more voting power, I think that would be a great, that I can see why that would be an interesting way to strike back against the rule of these barren cat ladies. However, like you said, long-term in a multiracial society where they already have more kids, it will be a disaster. The end result will simply be Black women voting for more welfare so they have even more kids. So it'll just be, have more kids, get more welfare, get more votes. It'll just accelerate the decline of democracy, which might be a good thing. I'm fundamentally opposed to at least modern mass democracy. So maybe that'd be a good thing, just help it fall faster. But overall, I think that's a little too much like playing with fire. I have to say it's a bad idea.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think it's a bad idea. A bad idea from a guy who's way better than the Republican average. J.D. Vance has said things about the white working class, which is, and he hasn't been saying bad things about them. Usually politicians will say only bad things about white people specifically, but he stood up for the interests of white working people. And I think that's very, very good. So I think generally his ideas are good. And I think he's thinking about good issues, changing the franchise in America is absolutely necessary, but expanding it is probably not the best way of tweaking the franchise in America. Steve writes in with $100. This is super generous. So I'm going to answer this question. And then we're going to get into gaming. Question for Greg, which book by Tito Perdue should I read first and why? Well, because you've been so generous, I'm going to tell you two first books you should read. It depends on which one you can get. One is The Node, which is available from Nine Banded Books. I have a review of it at Countercurrents. It's a wonderful book. It's a very, very interesting dystopian satire of an anti-white America in the future, and a model for the white resistance that's taking place. It's surreal. It's funny. It's very witty. It's very well written. The other is a book called Reuben. Now, that was published by Radix, and I believe it's out of print, but Tito apparently has gotten the rights to reprint it away from Radix, and so he's going to reprint that very soon. And so while you're waiting for Reuben to come out in a new edition, go to Nine Banded Books, look up Chip Smith. He's a great publisher of alternative literature, really open-minded, brave guy, and pick up The Node by Tito Perdue. And, you know, fill your cart with some of his other books too, because he's a very good guy and definitely worth supporting. I think a lot of you would find his catalog at Nine Banded Books extremely appealing. So let's begin talking to American Krogan about BioShock. Can you just give us a little bit of background suitable for old people like me who don't really know much about the whole world of gaming? Just a little bit of background and then talk about your take on this series. Folks, I've watched the first video of this and on the first BioShock game or series, I guess, and I thought it was excellent in content, in production. It's just excellent. It's exemplary cultural analysis from our point of view of cultural rot produced from their point of view. And I've also looked at about 80% of the series that he put out on the next BioShock, which is also quite masterfully done. So I think this is extremely important work, and I just want to congratulate you about it. So let's get other people excited about it. So give us a little background on BioShock.
Well, BioShock was developed by a guy named Ken Levine, who was a member of the tribe. It came out in the year 2007. And over time, the whole franchise has probably sold somewhere around 38 million units. And it's probably made somewhere, as of 2015, I think it's made half a billion dollars in revenue. Sorry about that. The guy who is the CEO of the publisher, a guy named Strauss Zelnick, is also a member of the tribe, and he engaged in basically a investor takeover of the publisher in 2007, shortly before the game was published. So that's some interesting backstory there. But BioShock was always going to be a game about a Jewish perspective. Originally, before the game reached its final developmental iteration, it was going to be about a secret Nazi base that archaeologists in the 20th century discovered. And there were going to be all these weird Nazi experiments that the player would happen upon. Eventually, when the game came out, it took on the form of sort of this critique of Ayn Rand-themed libertarianism or objectivism. And that's what most people think of when they think of the game. Most of the commentary when the game came out was squarely centered on that. Nobody was thinking about the ethnic undertones at play. It's very, very, very Jewish.
Well, let me just back up and talk about a couple of things here that I think are really interesting. Let's just talk a little bit about the Ayn Rand stuff. Because of course Ayn Rand herself was Jewish. And she represents a particular type of Jewish intellectual. There are different types of Jewish intellectuals, different types of Jewish political movements, but they still remain somehow identifiably Jewish. So you can have Jewish intellectual and political movements of the right and Jewish intellectual political movements of the left and the center. They want to colonize the whole political spectrum. Rand was a libertarian individualist. She preached that racism was a primitive form of collectivism. She called it barnyard collectivism. Her only examples of racist societies, interestingly enough, were the American South and Tsarist Russia. Now, Tsarist Russia was of course, thinking of racism against Jews, and she was a Russian Jew. She despised Russia. She hated Russia. She thought that Russian culture and tradition meant absolutely nothing. In fact, she described the opponents of Bolshevism as fighting for things like religion and tradition and the monarchy and all these other things, Russia. And then she summed it up and she said, in short, absolutely nothing. All of that meant absolutely nothing to her. And she despised Russia. She loathed it. Her family were bourgeois, capitalist Jews. They had their property expropriated. They ended up being miserable, and she finally fled the country. She found a way of weaseling out and never came back. Came to the United States, became a successful novelist and advocate of libertarian individualism. Now, it's very, very interesting, though, that Ayn Rand's colorblind anti-racist individualism led to strange results. People noticed patterns. They noticed that even though Ayn Rand was a believer in colorblind individualist meritocracy and anti-collectivist, she seemed to gravitate mostly, her husband was a goy, but she gravitated mostly towards other Jews. And her little inner circle, with the single exception of her husband, were almost entirely Jewish, almost entirely of Russian Jewish descent, specifically. And if you made any aspersions about that fact, well, you were engaged in some form of sinister collectivism, right? And so it was very, very clear that there was some kind of concealed ethnic affinity at work in the objectivist movement. After Ayn Rand died, an Ayn Rand Institute was set up by one of her followers, Leonard Peikoff, Jewish. And then after Peikoff, it was run by this guy named Michael Berliner, Jewish. After Berliner stepped down, a guy named Yaron Brook, who claims to be a former, an Israeli citizen and a former Mossad agent, took over and ran the thing. It is an extremely Jewish intellectual movement, yet it is officially opposed to any form of collectivism, interestingly enough. But they're rabidly pro-Israel, rabidly Zionist, and have all kinds of extremely negative and dismissive stereotypes about the peoples of the Middle East that have been displaced by Jews. So, you know, I noticed this. I was involved in objectivism. I read Ayn Rand's books, and I went to some of the conferences that they put on and read some of their publications. And after a while, I just started noticing things, but you couldn't talk about these things. I thought that is a hallmark of Jewish intellectual movements. They set things up in a way that make it possible for Jews to rise to positions of influence, and they throw sand in the eyes of any people who would notice the pattern of ethnic nepotism that's taking place. And you can say the same thing about the Frankfurt School. They're far leftists, they're Freudo-Marxists, right? Yet they are not concerned about emancipating the workers. They're concerned about emancipating the marginalized. And the Frankfurt School basically is a way of promoting Jewish upward mobility and throwing sand in the eyes of people who had noticed that there was a pattern here.
I should probably say that the game Bioshock takes place in 1960. It takes place in an underwater dystopia that's based on objectivism. So superficially, it's meant to be taken superficially as a critique of objectivism. But what you find as the layers get peeled back is that it's essentially criticizing all forms of non-Jewish collectivism. I mean, as the game unfolds, Andrew Ryan, which is, you know, a play on Anne Ryan's name. So Andrew Ryan is a Belarusian Jew who fled the Soviet takeover, and he went to America. But America was super racist and anti-Semitic, as well as the game outlines. And so he establishes this underwater objectivist utopia. And what you find is that over time, it's the Gentiles who come into this objectivist utopia and undermine it with Christian collectivism and other sorts of movements. And the game basically concludes that it's sort of like this Jewish utopia that gets ruined by the Goyim. It's this entire reversal of that accusation toward the Jews of being parasitical toward their host society. It's very, very bizarre stuff. The ending, the final boss scene, is actually you fighting this warped Nazi Übermensch, this guy named Frank Fontaine, and he's stuck on this what looks like a cross, and you, the player, are actually the. I mean, it's so convoluted. That's why this stuff is hard to talk about. It's extremely convoluted. Like, so you are the son of this guy, Andrew Ryan, as the player character, and you only find this out toward the end of the game. And when you're fighting this Gentile who has subverted Andrew Ryan's society, you're injecting him with this needle as he's up on this cross. So it has all these like anti-Christian, anti-Christ references as well. It's like I said, it's really, really bizarre stuff. But yeah, superficially, it's supposed to be a critique of objectivism, but it's really a critique of collectivism.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's a wonderful writer named Florence King. She's dead now. She was the only person who wrote for National Review, aside from Peter Brimlow, I guess. The only person, and Joe Sobrin. Well, there are a few, but they all got purged. She was the only person worth reading in National Review that never got purged by William F. Buckley. Let me put it that way. She was a humorist, and she wrote this book of essays called With Charity Toward None. And there's a chapter in there where she talks about Ayn Rand. And she lays it out beautifully. She said, basically, you look at Atlas Shrugged, and even though Rand claimed to be a race-blind individualist, it's very Jewish, and it's kind of Zionist, and it's anti-Goy. Basically, the plot of Atlas Shrugged is there's this scientist who's portrayed in a very Aryan-looking way. In Rand's novels were filled with very Nordic types, interestingly enough. She liked the Nordic aesthetic. But there's this guy named John Galt who is going around convincing the creative people, intellectuals, inventors, businessmen, that they're being exploited by parasitic masses of inferiors, and that they need to go on strike. And if they go on strike, they can break the power of their inferiors and basically dictate terms of society to their liking. And so they go off to this place in the mountains of Colorado called Galt's Gulch, which is the sort of like Ryan's underwater city, right?
Yeah.
And what King says is that this is basically a sort of a Jewish fantasy. Jews feel like they are being parasitized by their mental inferiors who resent them, and they need to go off on their own and withdraw their Promethean fire, their all their genius from the rest of the world, so the world will finally capitulate and accept their terms. And Galt's Gulch is sort of like Zion, basically. It's like a Zionist redoubt, basically.
Ken Levine has talked about this in numerous articles, that in many ways, Rapture, his underwater city, which is, you know, etymologically, you know, the Greek word for, you know, to take away.
Yeah.
He's talked about how Rapture is somewhat of a proxy for Israel. And what he does over the course of his series is he takes all the crimes of Israel and he blames them on past atrocities committed against the Jews. I should have had quotes prepared for this, but yeah, that's essentially what he does. It's interesting that you brought up the Promethean fire thing again, because that is also something in the first game. The accusation toward the antagonist of the game, Frank Fontaine, is that he is sort of Prometheus stealing the fire from Hephaestus, and Andrew Ryan is Hephaestus. And so again, it's truly this idea of these Gentiles came in and they stole the Jewish genius and ruined an otherwise perfect society.
Yeah, that's there's a lot of projection going on there, isn't there?
Yeah. That's
inversion.
Yeah, and that's not only a trend in this game, it's a trend, if you go into the video game industry and you look at various instances where there was a Jewish creative developer, for example, Neil Druckmann in the Last of Us series, it's the same they do the same thing over and over and over again. They project, like, The Last of Us Part 2 is essentially a whole proxy narrative for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And Neil Druckmann superimposes that entire conflict onto Gentile avatars and then sort of, you know, blames everything on Gentiles, and then in the end still manages to have this somewhat slanted positive take toward the proxy for Israel. They do this across most of the media and video games that they're involved in. So it's a trend not just in this series, but across the entire industry.
I'm sort of feeling my way through a discussion of something that's very foreign to me. But like I said, I watched the entirety of the first series video, and I thought it was really fascinating. And there's just so many layers to this. The portrayal of this Fontaine character, his voice and everything, he's portrayed he's portrayed as an East Coast ethnic goy Untermensch with a really ugly urban accent. It's an extremely negative caricature. It might as well be named Guido Fontaine or something like that. There's so many things about this that are crude stereotypes. There's a crudeness about this, but then there's a complexity. There's layer upon layer of lies and
that's why it's exceedingly difficult to break this stuff down and to make videos on it, because it's just so convoluted. You start out the game with this Frank Fontaine character actually being a guy named Atlas. And, you know, that's no coincidence. It's a theme from Atlas Shrugged. The idea is that, I can't see it's so convoluted. Basically, he takes on this persona of this Irish bloke who has this wife and daughter whom Frank Fontaine is holding hostage. And you think for half of the game that this guy's your friend. And then, but there are these subtle cues along the way that this guy's actually very evil. there's this a magical substance called Atom in the game that alters people's genetic makeup. And of course, there are these devices called, well, they're little sisters. They're these little girls who have these sea slugs implanted in their bellies, and they these sea slugs have this magical ability to produce this magical substance called Atom. And for some reason, it can only be produced if it's implanted in these little girls' bellies. And there are these things called Big Daddies that are like golems, and they protect these little sisters from the rest of society that is, you know, Atom crazed, and they want to do anything they can to get this Atom. So as the game progresses, Atlas is vilified because he's telling you to go around harvesting all of these little girls to get their Atom so you can become more powerful to take down Andrew Ryan. So the game's telling you subtly, well, this guy's not really who he says he is. He's kind of a bad guy. And you find out toward the end of the game that he's not who he says he is. He's Frank Fontaine. He's this guy who has been vying for power and rapture since the beginning, and he faked his own death and so on and so forth. And then he reveals himself to be this very crude figure. And so the narrative wants to sort of convey to the audience that who you think is the good guy isn't really the good guy, and who you think is the antagonist isn't really the antagonist. So Andrew Ryan is initially portrayed as the antagonist, but then you find out, well, actually, he's the good guy. And actually, he was the Atlas holding up Rapture. He was holding up the heavens. He was holding everything up. And you indirectly, because you were brainwashed by this Atlas figure, by this Frank Fontaine, you have now destroyed society. And now it's your task to undermine this, you know, pseudo-Nazi. Again, it's very, very convoluted, bizarre stuff. And so I hope what I'm saying makes some sense. But if it doesn't, please go watch the video.
Well, yeah, I think Go ahead.
Yeah, I think I can kind of help explain it more to the audience, what the essence of the Big Daddy's little sisters are. It's actually transhumanism. Because I forgot her name, but the professor who did a lot of research on them, she got into it because she said that she can make
Tenenbaum.
The weak strong. Yeah, Tenenbaum. She can make the weak strong and the black white. So here we have a very strong transhuman element where you get this first substance from the sea slugs to the little sisters. But what it does is it really allows you to be whatever you want to be, which to me, okay, weak strong, why not male, female, or vice versa?
This is another trend, in like Neil Druckmann did the same thing. You notice that the sea slugs are parasites. And so, again, we have this bizarre theme of parasitism. And Neil Druckmann in The Last of Us, he's very obsessed with that as well. Like the big premise of the game is this parasitical fungus that attaches itself to humans and then takes over them. And Neil Druckmann, in various interviews with Mashable.com, has talked about how he did all this research on various types of wasps and spiders that would, I think it was a type of wasp in South America that would lay its egg on a spider and then it would eventually hatch and eat the spider. So like these people are very obsessed with themes of parasitism and like reworking them in various ways. So that's what stood out to me. But as far as the transhumanism goes, yeah, I would say that is a theme as well, because, you know, Dr. Steinman, who is, you know, one of the elite doctors that Andrew Ryan brought to his utopia. He's this plastic surgeon. He talks about, you know, oh, we can shave down a beak here. We can, you know, do this or that there. He's talking about like this Jewish obsession with, you know, covering their Jewish features. And Steinman talks about changing your race via this magical Atom. He talks about changing your sex. There are themes of transhumanism in there, but I don't know if that has a whole lot to do with the Big Daddies themselves. I think the Big Daddies are more of like this weird proxy for golems. But again, the problem with this material is that it's just so weird. It's so foreign. Greg, you said at one point on a stream a couple weeks back that these people just have a very different moral paradigm. And I think that is how most people should look at it. They just have a very, very, very different perspective about things. And so when we get down into the nitty-gritty of analyzing the media that they produce, often it's very hard for us to understand because it's just so foreign. It's just so bizarre.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's basically it's a first-person shooter type game. You're entering into a world that's completely structured by, let's just be frank, Jewish neurosis. I mean, the yes. whole thing is just incredibly neurotic and hateful towards us ultimately. And so it's basically an encapsulation of what it's like to live in the broader culture, but it's an extremely intense, immersive experience of being trapped inside a neurotic Jew's head, which is yes. really, you know, what it's like to be alive in Western civilization today. Whenever you turn on the TV or turn on the radio or whatever, it's just all the inner machinations and foldings and twistings and turnings of Jewish neurosis. And of course, we're one of the objects of their neurotic fears and hatreds. So it's kind of demoralizing and horrifying when you see what's going on here. And yeah, there's references to the Nazi concentration camps. Of course, they can't do anything without that.
But curiously, the most curious thing about that whole first game is that nowhere do they explicitly mention the word Jew, Jewish, or Judaism. He specifically went out of his way to not mention any kind of overt naming. All of the information you get about all the various characters' Jewish backgrounds are either inferred, or they're, you know, historical references like you just mentioned, or they are via articles written by Ken Levine himself, or interviews in which he talks about this. So the game really does have this superficial narrative meant for non-Jews, and then a sort of subtext that only informed Jews are going to be able to pick up on. So that's another really bizarre.
They do this all the time. This is crypsis. This is esoteric writing. It's got one message for the masses, the Koyim, and another message that can be decoded by the insiders, the tribe, basically. Yeah, this is the Jewish playbook up one side and down the other. Komi Kobayashi likes BioShock and is in the chat, and he's also moderating. Thank you very much. So he wants you to talk a little bit about Xander Cohen.
I was just thinking about him.
Yeah, the stuff in there, basically Xander Cohen is some kind of homosexual pedophile, and your role in the game is to hunt down his victims.
Yeah. So you're working your way toward the Hephaestus core in the game, which is Andrew Ryan's control hub for Rapture. And at this certain point, you have to go through an area called Fort Frolic, and it's totally imposed on the player. Like, you can't circumvent this path. You have to go down this path. You are trapped in there, and you have to do this guy, Xander Cohen's bidding. And you know, the name Xander Cohen is really interesting because Cohen is Hebrew for priest. So right off the bat, there's this undertone there. And he's this, you know, eccentric artist that was totally misunderstood by high New York society. And he was kind of resentful about it. And Ken Levine talks about this as well. There are these themes of him being like super, super smart, super, super talented, and nobody else understands it but him. And you have to go through this area, and he has this artistic quatique he set up. It's basically, he has gone around Fort Frolic murdering everybody and covering their dead bodies with plaster. And he set up this quatique in the atrium. And there are these picture frames that you have to fill with the photographs of his dead disciples that you are tasked with killing. And again, you can't circumvent any of this. You have to go do all of this. And as you hunt these people down, and by the way, there's no real reason or moral framing as to why you should hunt these people down and kill them. It's just, so that's kind of bizarre. You're hunting down the victims of this homosexual Jewish priest. And as you hunt them down, there are these little audio cues they say things that talk about how Xander Cohen had, you know, abused them and molested them and done horrible things to them. And in the end, you can technically kill Sander Cohen, but most people, if you look at, there's data on this, most people don't, because the game doesn't really coax you into doing that. So again, it's just really, really bizarre stuff. And you have to ask yourself, why did Ken Levine want to explore this? What were the intellectual ideas being explored here? Like, what was the purpose of this? And I'm still kind of at a loss for that, to be honest. It just seems extremely bizarre, extremely macabre and grotesque. And most people, the overwhelming majority of people, are not aware of the homosexual undertones, let alone the fact that Sander Cohen is Jewish. So again, two narratives, you know, one for the Goyim, one for the Jews.
Yeah, fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
I can add a little bit what's going on there is that the Jewish neuroticism where they want to be control freaks. Like one of the things you mentioned in the video was, I think it's in the later ones with the American game, but it was constancy and variables. You have no free will. This is a kind of like a Jewish power fantasy where they can make the Goyim, us, do bizarre, weird, stupid stuff, debase ourselves and get away with it and laugh. Like the producers were laughing. I think you mentioned in the videos that there was a lot of fourth wall breaking later on. So I think this is like this weird, sick game of let's make the gamer do this and we'll laugh at it. When in reality, we always had a choice. We always had a choice to maybe walk away from the game. I think that translates over into real life too. Right now, the Jews want us to do stuff that's stupid. They won't want us to acquiesce to basically pedophilia textbooks. They want us to wear a cuck muzzle in public like a coward because of the flu.
Well, and, I should say too that
we can always say no. We can stop playing the game. We can always exit society. We don't need their free crap, their little plastic crap that was imported from China, at least while the supply chain was running. Their greatest fear is that we will stop playing their game and realize that we have free will.
Well, I should say, too, that as the series progresses, there are indications that Sander Cohen and other people within Rapture were engaged in child trafficking. And that's something that has to do with the Little Sisters as well. Frank Fontaine sets up these orphanages for Little Sisters because, as the Jewish scientist Tenenbaum discovers, only Adam can be cultivated inside the stomachs of little girls. Again, this is quite bizarre stuff. So Frank Fontaine sets up an orphanage for little girls, and then they go around and then they start kidnapping little girls, and they hold them in these orphanages, and they implant them with sea slugs so they can harvest Adam. But again, that kind of ties into this weird way of putting that sin on Frank Fontaine, the Goy avatar, because as the series develops, you find out that Tenenbaum is very remorseful about having been involved in that, whereas Frank Fontaine remains this two-bit villain that has no remorse for any of that and did it all for self-gain and just has, you know, no remorse. So, again, it's very convoluted, crazy stuff, and I think the best way to describe it is, you know, neurosis of some kind.
Well, as convoluted as it is, I thought you were absolutely masterful at going through this and laying out all the layers. It was very impressive. It's well-paced. You use music effectively, sometimes hilariously, frankly. So I really love it. And, it, you know, it's radical. You say radical stuff, but everything is extremely well-documented. And I love that. You sort of calmly lay it all out and document it, but keep the pace up, keep the interest peaked, and keep us going to the next thing. So yeah, I think it's masterful as a explication of some incredibly sick propaganda, and a lot of people are just eating this up. It's a $500 million game. It's quite amazing.
Well, what's interesting is how the media behaves. In how the media treated the game when it first came out, like a lot of gamers were basically saying that it was sort of like this mediocre shooter, and a lot of people in the gaming press were just giving it just fairly undeserved praise, and that has just been the trend going forward with the series. Everybody just, you know, swings from Ken Levine's nuts, so to speak.
Well, I think part of that, I think you should look at the early life sections of all the critics. There's a great deal of that kind of Jewish log rolling and back scratching and puffery in all fields of the media.
It is, but it's effective. And at this point, BioShock is really part of Western gaming iconography. It's really part of the cultural milieu of gaming. Like, everybody knows the phrases, "Would you kindly?" They know Andrew Ryan. They know all the catchphrases. It's part of gamers' psyche. And that's very, very interesting, once again, because 99.9% of the gamers aren't aware of any of these subtexts or sub-narratives. And most people, when I made the videos, were very receptive, and they more or less agreed with you that it was well thought out and well presented. But there's always that subset of people who just can't accept it. Like, no matter how many Ken Levine quotes you cite, no matter how many instances in which these people will reveal their true intentions, there's always that subset of, you know, Gentile gamers or the Gentile audience who will just twist and turn and make whatever possible excuse they can to justify the behavior in their mind and rationalize it. And again, that just speaks to me about the power of media and how, to a certain extent, it doesn't matter how rational or well thought out or well presented your argument is. It matters who controls the mass media. It matters, the nature of media matters. And a lot of people aren't going to respond to anything favorably to us unless, you know, there's media supporting our messages.
Right. Well, I do think it's very important to analyze this material. This is why I write reviews of movies. I've been writing movie reviews for 20 years now, almost. And why do I do it? Because this is so powerful. This is the fake world that they have constructed for us. And they have invested billions of dollars. They have huge armies of talented people producing this increasingly noxious anti-white propaganda. We have a few little outposts on the internet. However, if we can teach people to see through what they're doing, if we can teach people to decode the messages, then suddenly all the propaganda in the world doesn't reinforce their message, it reinforces ours. And we've accomplished this basically with almost no resources at all. And this, so it's a highly effective form of asymmetric cultural warfare where, you know, you and I can teach people to read, to see through these lies and decode this, and they can go out and they can decode it everywhere. And suddenly the brainwashing machine works in reverse. It reinforces our message, not theirs. I think that's a hugely important task.
Yes. If like you were talking about this with Endeavor a few weeks ago, and he was sort of the mindset, he leaned more toward the idea of us disengaging with pop culture. And I agree much more with your take insofar that, you know, we have to engage with it because boycotting it isn't really going to have any effect. We don't have the numbers to have any effect on it, like you've said. And by engaging with it in constant, like, a lot of people get mad at me because I bought the latest AAA game when I should be boycotting it. But what I can do is I can review the game, break it down, and then give people the tools to go and do that ad nauseum in their lives. And then what you have is you reverse the effect of the anti-white propaganda, and it becomes sort of, it starts to have the opposite effect. It will start to make more and more and more white people angry, and it will. Yeah.
There's a very good, I wonder if there's a way I can share this with the chat. I'll try and find out. There was a thing I saw, I think it was on Gab today. It had to have been Gab. I've been exiled from Twitter, but it was a cartoon, and it was like the stages of noticing. I think it was a Hedgewick or something like that cartoon, it was quite good. It was basically it was sort of like the stages of grief, right? It was basically the stages that people go through when they're confronted with our arguments about the JQ in really any setting. And I think I'm going to find it just in a second here, so bear with me, because it's very good. And they go through this, they went through this with my movie reviews. I have friends. There are people I have converted to our way of thinking because I wrote a really intelligent review of a movie that they loved, and they were giant fans of this, and they were Googling around and they found it, and they were invested in this franchise. I hate that word, but they were deeply invested in this stuff. And it, they thought my takes were intelligent, and they started noticing. Yeah, it's a Hedgewick cartoon. I've shared it on my Gab page. The five stages of noticing: denial. Everything you say about them is fake. They're no more represented than anyone else. Then the anger stage: you're a horrible person misrepresenting facts. Just because they hold some key positions of influence doesn't mean anything. Then the bargaining phase is, all right, fine. They are a bit overrepresented in those fields and institutions, but that's only because of their hard work ethic and culture. And then the acceptance phase, okay, they absolutely fill those fields and institutions. They clearly networked over time to get where they are now, but I'm not sure that's a bad thing. And then the final phase of noticing is depression. Well, I don't quite like that being the final phase. The final phase is depression every single time, right?
That's so interesting that's more or less the path through which my metamorphosis on YouTube occurred.
Yeah.
I started my channel more or less as a mediocre gaming / technology channel. Like, I would talk about AI and other stuff, like somewhere around 2015, 2016. And I had moved to Latin America some years prior. And I was kind of depressed about how things were going down here, because I wasn't interacting with people. Like, the interactions with people weren't going the way I thought they should go, considering I was this anti-racist, egalitarian libtard. And over time, I came across videos by yourself, videos by Jared Taylor, videos by Mark Collett, and Cultured Thug and some other people. And all the pieces started to make more and more sense. And then I started to kind of get into, I read some literature about Jews, and I was just like, I went through those exact stages more or less the way you just outlined. And I even made a video on YouTube about Jordan Peterson and his, blog post on the so-called Jewish question. And, I dismantled all of that, went through all of that. And the way I was thinking about it at the time was more or less along the lines of, well, yeah, maybe they do have a slightly higher IQ, and maybe, they are there by their own merits or whatever, but, they're not, Jordan Peterson said at one point in his blog post, should we really be upset about people who are working for our mutual benefit? And at the time, I took issue with that, because I had seen enough evidence to know that they are not working toward everybody's mutual benefit. They're working for their own benefit. And that really made me angry about Peterson, because Peterson always talks about identity politics and how bad and cringe they are and so on and so forth, but he will never, never discuss how Jews engage viciously in identity politics. But still, even at that point when I made that video, I wasn't quite on board with the idea that they are these... I don't think I had read Culture of Critique yet. And I still, I was sort of in this depressive state still. It was like, I didn't really want to accept that they were exceedingly anti-white and hated us. But shortly after that, I got to that point where I just accepted that in some kind of aggregate sense, their identity is largely based on victimhood. And in that identity of victimhood, we are more often than not the villain. We are the
victimizers.
Yeah. And you can't, I'm not some nut job who wants to genocide people or anything like that. But my take is just essentially you can't live around people like that, because they're not going to ever have an honest conversation with you. They're not going to be sincere. They're always going to operate from that mentality of being a victim and you're the perpetrator. And, you have to have a divorce from people like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thomas, do you want to add anything here? I don't want to.
Yes, I do quite a bit, actually. It's very interesting. So starting the victimhood thing, I realized that in the videos and in the game, it seemed like you made the good point that because they were victims, whoever has the victim card, they can do whatever. For example, Bioshock 1, everyone who's Jewish has a victimhood card, so they can do crazy stuff. And there's no consequence, only the goyim who are criticized. Same with Infinite, the Vox Populi, because they were victims, they're allowed to do all this stuff. And the game pretend, you really broke about how the game tried to be even-handed or pretended to and failed spectacularly because they were never really censored like the main protagonists or all the European characters were. And you see it playing out in real life. Like right now, the Jew victimhood, well, I'm the victim, so I can basically destroy white society. They pass it off to literally every other race who hates us, like blacks. Blacks were always resentful, but they kind of weren't crazy until Jews taught them, hey, here's a thing called a victimhood card. You can scream racism and you can literally burn down Kenosha, try to kill, have your fellow minions who are probably Jews or crazy white people try to kill Adrian Boyd like Kyle. But you know what? Kyle's the aggressor here. St. Kyle Rittenhouse, he's a bad man because he defended himself because he's a white man. He can't be a victim, but a Jewish pedophile, a bunch of blacks burning down business, they're the perpetual victims.
Well, I mean, it's so the Rittenhouse case is so bizarre because in some ways, like, you know, like Rosenbaum kind of corresponds to Sander Cohen to some extent. I mean, he obviously Rosenbaum wasn't, you know, a rabbi or a priest or anything like that. He wasn't an artist, but, you know, he was this child molester. And, you know, Sander Cohen was that. So, again, it's like all these there are all these weird overlaps with the BioShock series with modern contemporary politics. It's and you're absolutely right. That's what they do throughout the entire series. They explain to everybody how their past victimhood gives them the right. It justifies and excuses all of their morally abhorrent behaviors. And it tells the audience that, you know, yeah, some of these people have done bad things, but they only did those bad things because there was this prime mover, and the prime mover was, you know, white racism.
This is great.
That meme of like or cartoon where it's like the Jew covered in blood saying, "Why do they persecute me?" So he has like a bloody knife.
That's a classic by A. Wyatt Mann.
Yeah. But another quick thing too.
Yeah.
So the undeserving praise of video games and other forms of media, at least in video games, I have some white pills, it seems to be falling apart. So all the media, I'm not sure if this is for Jewish reasons or general subversion is profit, but Cyberpunk was supposed to be the game of the year, and they spent, I think, more money on advertising than actually developing a good game. So it blew up in their face. I never played it. I'm more of a strategy or sword and sorcery type of guy. But everyone said it was crap. Poorly made, and it seemed just almost like an excuse for degeneracy. Like you can modify your genitals and all this like weird transhuman crap.
Well, yeah, that's that game's interesting because, you know, Mike Pondsmith, the original developer of the Cyberpunk world, always said that the fictional world he developed was supposed to be a quote unquote warning about how bad the future could become. And what we see with games like Cyberpunk is that it's not really a warning anymore. These people are very enthusiastic about this future dystopia that awaits us. I mean, people are you know, like the developers put all these dildos everywhere in the game. There's all these sex-changing themes and whatnot, and all kinds of very weird, degenerate themes that are, if you look at the game and you play it, they're just being celebrated. It's not present. None of these themes are being presented as like something that's going to tear society apart and make everybody miserable and unhappy. It's, you know, most players who engage with the game are like, this stuff's cool. I can't wait to be able to swap out my lower jaw with some mechanical mandible, you know, or I can't wait to swap out my eyes with some kind of, you know, cybernetic implant or whatever. Like, and this stuff's just a celebration of, you know, this transhumanist future. And yeah, it's just a celebration. It's not a condemnation.
So we have a few questions here for American Krogan over at Entropy. Folks, if you would like to help out and ask questions, go to entropystream.live /countercurrents and hit the green button, leave a donation and a question, and we will be happy to get to them. So you can also send your DLive tokens to us. Those add up, and those will help us meet our fundraising goal as well. We've received more than $1,000 worth of DLive tokens since the beginning of our fundraiser. We're trying to raise $200,000 this year, so we got 1/200th of the way there with your diamonds, lemons, ice cream, Ninja Genies, a few Ninjets here and there. So folks, if you would like to help out that way, toss them in as well. Bartleby donated 2 ice cream. And there were several others that were in my stream, my feed here, but they seem to have disappeared. And I apologize, folks, if you gave something earlier today and I didn't acknowledge it. So definitely send your DLive tokens as well. So over at Entropy, Scott has sent $5 and asks, American Krogan, I take it you're a fan of the Mass Effect series. What's your take on the ending of Mass Effect 3? And do you have high hopes for the next title considering how Mass Effect Andromeda turned out?
Well, actually, that's a good question because when I made... Yeah, I have a whole video. I have 2 big videos that address all the themes in Mass Effect. And what I would say about the third game's ending is that... Well, the entire series from the trilogy, the first game sort of sends the players down this path of recognizing that humanity no longer has any distinctions among ourselves. Like, we are all one race, and we're no longer racist, but now we have to deal with xenophobia toward aliens. And then over the course of the series, it starts to talk about how, well, now we no longer have any distinctions between ourselves and aliens. Now we got to worry about distinctions between ourselves and inorganic AI. So it constantly, the quote that came to mind to me as I was making the videos was William Luther Pierce's, "The compulsion to be undiscriminating is a progressive disease. It doesn't stop at any point. It just gets worse and worse." And that's Mass Effect. The ending of Mass Effect culminates with this idea that you have to have this sort of giant galactic miscegenation of all the different life forms in order to end conflict once and for all. That is literally the ending. There are these weird ancient inorganic species called the Reapers, and they basically come into the Milky Way galaxy every 50,000 years, and they harvest all the different life forms, and then they incorporate them into themselves. So they're like this sort of hybrid between organic and inorganic life. But the ending of the game basically has you doing exactly, like over the entire series, you're fighting these Reapers because they're presented as evil. But in the end of the series, you're basically given the idea of, well, the Reapers were right all along, and we should just all become one giant combined organism, and then everything will be all right. So I don't have any hope for the future of Mass Effect. I think I think it was nefarious from the get-go, and I think it's only going to get worse. The sort of good news, I suppose, is that Mass Effect Andromeda was so bad and so poorly received by the audience that for, you know, one brief moment, that trope about, you know, get woke, go broke was actually real. They canceled the DLC. They didn't continue development. Though, you know, there is going to be a sequel at some point. But yeah, I have no hope for it. And neither should anybody, neither should any fans. You should all condemn the whole series and never play it again. It's junk. It's garbage. It's nefarious. It's bad stuff.
Great. Thomas, do you have any thoughts on Mass Effect that you'd like to add?
I actually haven't played Mass Effect. I did play Dragon Age, which I think is similar to Mass Effect, made by the same group. But yeah, there were some themes that weren't... I feel like I play a lot of fantasy games. I feel like it's harder to insert degeneracy and politics into fantasy games. So they do try. Like, there was a game called one of the Baldur's Gate games, not the original ones, original Baldur's Gates, but one that came a few years ago, that is like weird, crazy. They try to be like all gender fluid too, and now they had like some really annoying like elf mage who did chaos magic, she was like pity her, and all this other woke stuff. They kept adding in stuff like very it didn't fit well. It was hard to fit into a fantasy world.
Yeah,
so it
yeah
blew
they,
up
they keep ramming that,
and right now they're Baldur's Gate 3 is in development. It's in the alpha stage. People can play the beta or whatever. And I think the most they've gone is like maybe pronouns, and they don't have any other, like, which is sad to say good for the current year. Like, they at least, Baldur's Gate at least backed off. But I think from what you told me, Mass Effect is going to get crazier and crazier.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It'll get crazier. But you brought up Baldur's Gate, and what's interesting about that is the developers put out a composite character of what most players wanted to create as far as their player avatar. And they were all, I think it was Baldur's Gate, and they were all upset because it was just this generic white male. And they were all upset because they had added in these devil horns and all these weird colors, and you could be like gender fluid and all this other weird stuff. And yet most players wanted this generic white male. And it was this meme going around in our circles for a while because it was just like, it just showed how top down and contrived the whole, faking gay, LGBTQ, transgender, you know, agenda is in gaming.
High elf power.
Okay, so we have another question here for American Krogan. Scott also writes in with $20. Thank you very much. A game like Assassin's Creed Valhalla defeats the purpose of using advancements in gaming hardware to create realistic historical worlds. Valhalla begins in a Viking settlement, and while it looks good visually, it fails to recreate the Viking world by spoiling it with a racially diverse longboat crew and female warriors. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I did a whole video about that as well. And Assassin's Creed Valhalla is interesting because it's exceedingly, not only is it anti-white, but it's anti-British, like more than anything else. Like you can totally tell it was Ubisoft taking a jab at British nationalism following, you know, Brexit. They were very, very angry as, you know, a multinational, originally French company. They were very, very angry about, you know, Britain's, you know, sort of half attempt to, you know, take back their country. And I think it was just a hit piece on the British, although it does attack, you know, Viking heritage and culture and whatnot as well. Like there's this whole ability for you to have this homosexual romance with a character. And that's just, you know, that wouldn't have happened. And so what Ubisoft does typically, they give this really good air of historicity to their games. Like they'll often have like these add-ons to their games after the fact where you can like walk around the world and just read entries, encyclopedia-esque entries. And you get this air as an uneducated young gamer consumer that these games are very authentic. And yet what they do is they ham-fist in or throw in all these other things that have nothing to do with history. And so that's how they get their message across. And this works in conjunction, you know, with the education and the education system and the larger media industrial complex, so to speak. You know, it reinforces all of these really weird, bizarre ideas. And that's how the Overton window gets pushed. And, you know, I should really stress this to people that gaming it's probably at the forefront of pushing the Overton window at this point, not film, not anything else. It's games. I mean, take, for example, the game Far Cry 6, which came out recently. Over half of the enemy combatants are women. You know, that's not something you can get away with in film. You know, like everybody at this point would still see a film like that and they'd kind of laugh. You know, like imagine making a film about, you know, D-Day or some kind of historical battle and like half the combatants are women. Like nobody would take that seriously. But in a game, for some reason, people do take it seriously. So food for thought.
Okay, let's move forward to the next question here. Our friend Gadius Maximus, who is not moderating today because he's at the AMREN conference, and I hope that he'll tell us all about that next Saturday. Gadius has sent in $30. Thank you very much. And he says, the Soyjack prosecutor in the Rittenhouse trial thinks Call of Duty trained Kyle to be a killer. I guess he didn't get the memo that Call of Duty bans true gamers for using gamer speech. What are your thoughts on this? Have you been following the Rittenhouse trial?
To some extent, not as much as yourself and other people, but I did see that and I commented on it and I made a composite video or a super cut video of the most recent Call of Duty, which is basically an Antifa Nazi murder fantasy fest. It's just scene after scene of all these people mowing down Nazis and killing Nazi prisoners of war and violating various international conventions over the treatment of prisoners. There's even a scene where you set a Nazi prisoner on fire. There's a scene where you're this woman and you're stabbing this Nazi yelling fascista or whatever not familiar with the Russian word for fascist, but you can tell it's the Russian word for fascist. And so it's very interesting that the prosecutors took that angle because Call of Duty, if anything, we should be asking, did Rosenbaum play Call of Duty? Did he maybe, you know, play the Antifa fantasy simulator a little too much and then, you know, misinterpret Kyle Rittenhouse and everybody else as a Nazi? Yeah.
Well, I think the whole, basically the liberal media believers are all playing that fantasy game. It's amazing how gaslighted the American public has been about this Rittenhouse thing, how completely misinformed a lot of people are. And it's interesting, now that the trial is basically wrapped up, there will be closing statements, I guess, Monday. The news has leaked out, and there are a lot of people who are honest to God shit libs who are embarrassed. And they're wondering why they've been so misinformed. They're wondering why they've been so lied to about this. It's actually a really interesting teachable moment here, as shit libs like to say. They're learning that they can't trust the media. And that is one of the defining traits about liberals. They are media believers. They believe the mainstream media.
This ties into, you know, the idea that, you know, a lot of our guys, you know, we get really mad at the normies because they believe all this nonsense. But the thing is, you know, I don't think we should get mad at normie libtard whites all the time. I mean, obviously, some of them are truly nefarious and malicious and just self-loathing and all of that. But a lot of, you know, normal white people are just that. They're not normal. They are normal. They wouldn't engage in any of these weird behaviors without this sort of anti-white media complex superimposed on them. I think that's something we really have to remember, and we have to not give in to the temptation to get super, super mad at some of these people and start to hate them ourselves, because that works against us. We have to remember the fact that we're fighting for these people as well, because these people are extensions of ourselves. You know, we need these people to win.
Absolutely. And there was a time when all of us were more or less blue-pilled. And the people that we are fighting against are just other people like us who just haven't awakened yet because they lack critical thinking skills, or because they haven't seen your video, or they haven't read my review. They haven't spoken to the right person yet. We have to think that, and because that's how we convert people. You know, just impotent rage and condemning the normies doesn't actually move the needle in our direction at all. So we just have to. There's a kind of meme that floats around in our circles that's, I think, extremely counterproductive, and I just marvel over it again and again. I've written about this in the past. There are people out there who, you know, on our side, who basically say about, say, normie conservatives, they get angry that normie conservatives disagree with us. Normie conservatives disavow us. Normie conservatives believe things that we don't believe. And there's this strange sense of entitlement that these people have wronged us by not believing what we believe. Well, no, it's all on us in the end. If the first of all, 99% of normie conservatives who disavow us doing so honestly, there are people out there who disavow us dishonestly, right? But they're a tiny minority. The vast majority of them believe different things, and we just haven't convinced them yet. So the problem is on us, you know. It's not on them, it's on us, because we haven't converted them yet. The assumption, though, is that somehow they're wronging us by not believing what we're believing, and the strong implication a lot of times is that they're dishonest. And I just don't think that's true.
Yeah, I agree.
To the extent that it is true, it's not productive to proceed with that assumption. Because if you talk to people, if people say blue-pilled things and you lied into them and
it pushes them away,
them being dishonest, you just get their backs up and push them away.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to go about. And this is what I learned on YouTube, and it's really a shame that I'm not on YouTube anymore, because now I'm mostly speaking to more of a niche audience who's already converted. And what I had tailored on YouTube was more or less an ability to reach, to bypass people's various defense mechanisms that they put up when you start talking about these topics. But the point is, there are ways to go about bypassing people's defense mechanisms. You know, one of the most basic ways is just to show them the inconsistencies. You know, like, you know, for example, recently the New York Times put out an article about how, oh, black Mississippians are farmers are losing out to white South African farmers who are being imported and whatnot. And it's like, okay, well, for how many years have we all been complaining about how Mexicans have been taking away jobs from white Americans? So you just point out the inconsistencies like that. And people are, I mean, it's boring for a lot of us who have kind of been, you know, around a little bit longer, who have kind of absorbed some of the more intellectually stimulating arguments. But these sort of grub arguments, you know, they're still effective. You know, if you highlight that to enough people, it gets the wheels turning. Well, why is this inconsistency here? Why? It does seem like there's this anti-white hatred. Like, why is that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's definitely frustrating having to deal with normies, but like, we have to have patience because traditionally they would not be involved in politics. I'm sure in the past people of all castes had very strong opinions about their lord, religion, but it wasn't they weren't making policy. Now it's like we have to expect people who simply aren't built for that. They're not bad. We do not need to have this whole we do not need to have the attitude in the BioShock game of these people are parasites or we can just go off without them. But that was not their place to do this. This isn't their game. But now in democracy, we expect them to do something that they just aren't really programmed for, which is to like think critically, give all the geopolitics. Like geopolitics are played by maybe 1%, maybe 5% of the population for most of history. And now, yeah, everyone would have an opinion on it, but they would probably be they wouldn't craft it. And it's actually a very complicated thing to expect someone to do. And we shouldn't, it's like if everyone had to do, I don't know, calculus. I'm not good at calculus. I'm not built for that. We're expecting them to do calculus because democracy makes it so they have to do that. But also, I think the best way to go about it is like just calm our rage. Like you said, don't attack them for it. Be understanding. But also, kind of like going off the Rittenhouse trial, we can impeach the journalist. We can always impeach. One of the best ways to do is don't just attack the argument, but attack the person making it. So the media, we've caught them in lie after lie after lie. So always ask them, okay, I say A, the media says B. But you know what? The media lied to you before on X, Y, and Z. And I know it's going to be a little controversial here. There's all like heated opinions on it. But the Let's Go Brandon thing, I like it. I love it because it's based upon catching the media in a brazen lie, their pants down. As a judge in Rittenhouse trial would say, don't get brazen with me. That was brazen. They're saying, Let's Go Brandon. No, it was F Joe Biden. So while it looks like it's toned down, it's milquetoast, it's always an indictment against the media. It's always saying, screw the journalist case because they're all liars. So yeah, you have to just get the people stop believing the media and hate the media, which they already kind of do.
What our side usually makes the mistake on is purity spiraling to the point where there will be some kind of aggregate sort of boomer-esque conservative movement that doesn't meet all of the explicit criteria we need for the quote unquote end game. And so we will disavow it and we won't use it to push the Overton window. And I think that's a big, big mistake on our part in some of our circles.
Yeah, I agree with this completely. Thomas, what are your thoughts about the Rittenhouse trial? Have you been following it?
I have been. I think it's kind of a seminal case for going to show that we're really ruled by midwits. The prosecutor, Absolutely. Who's high and mighty and thinks very highly of himself, he's actually frankly stupid, and he's drunk so much of his own Kool-Aid he cannot think rationally. And I think it's going to be a mistrial with prejudice, which is very rare in law. What that means is that the case is dismissed completely and they do not get a second shot at retrying it, because if they did, they basically got to see what the defense does and knows the defense strategy. So they're not going to allow the prosecution to willfully sabotage the case and cause a mistrial. So the prosecution gets to have a second bite of the apple and see what the other team had, what cards they have, and what strategies work on the jury. Because when you go before a jury, you want to always see the reaction. You don't really know how they're going to react to certain arguments. But now you see how they react to different arguments. And really, like, the guy was wearing a stupid Rebel Alliance pin in a court of law. That's like if I went to court wearing, I don't know, a Pokemon lapel or, like, some video game thing. It's just, like, very lowbrow. Like, stopping us. And he was caught drinking Soylent, too. And the judge is over it. Like, this liberal is facing a normie judge who's, I don't know his politics. I think he's just even-handed. And he's shocked that he doesn't get his way because he just screams these, like, ridiculous things, like the video game, like, he plays Call of Duty. Well, so does everybody. If he's smart, he would have gone over because he played Kaiserreich or Hoi 4.
Yeah.
But I think it's great. And part of the liberal backlash against this is that they're trying to make quotas for juries, I think. They're already, like, saying the jury is too white. Well,
yeah.
And that is going to backfire on them because all the data, the hard data, shows that colored people prefer their own. Whites are actually the most objective jurors.
That's why they want it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. We can't have objective juries. We can't have rule of law and black people. We've got to choose. I choose law. I choose civilization. We have to have a divorce. What the judge said when he was upbraiding that prosecutor, he said, "I don't know what you're up to." I think he was on the brink of saying, "I think you're trying to throw this case, basically, so you get another bite at it because you've failed so miserably." And that is why I think he should declare a mistrial. And he should basically say that, no, the prosecution has been acting in bad faith. They don't get another go at this. It would be basically just a violation of due process. And of course, the whole thing has reeked from the beginning. They brought these charges before they could have really weighed any evidence or even collected all the evidence. It was purely politically motivated.
I was just going to say that, you know, we're already seeing the media talk about how, you know, they're highlighting, oh, the judge made a racial comment about Asian food. And it's like it was a supply chain joke. And they're already, like, going full force with these gross mischaracterizations of the judge. You know, I think they also highlighted that he had, I mean, I think the most bizarre thing they highlighted, that people were highlighting, was that he had proud to be an American ringtone. It was just like, really? Like, that's evidence of racism? You know, like that's evidence of being biased? Like, it's just a very weird set of affairs.
Yeah,
they're only supposed to be patriotic. We were demanding the white people go die in the Middle East. Didn't you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a hate symbol now. But
yeah,
there are also some very revealing tweets that have been made by, you know, your typical tribesman. What was his name? Max Berger said something along the lines of, you know, the Kyle Rittenhouse trial is evidence that there's still this segment of white society that is willing to engage in violent oppression rather than hand over, you know, the white political majority rule to a new emerging multiracial majority.
Yeah, well, let's just be real here. There were four people who were after Rittenhouse. There was Rosenbaum. There was another guy with a very tribal name who fired a gunshot. He was the one who fired the first gunshot. I forget his name. And there was Huber. And then there's Gage Grosskreutz. So of the four people who went after Rosenbaum, after Rittenhouse, there was Rosenbaum, who was definitely Jewish. Huber, very probably Jewish. This other guy who fired a gun but didn't get shot had a very tribal name. And then there's Grosskreutz. Grosskreutz doesn't sound like a Jewish name to me. And I think we should be we should be careful. I mean, this is what, you know, the upper Midwest. If somebody's got a name like Grosskreutz in the upper Midwest is probably German name. But, you know, Jews can have any name they want, right? They can pick up any name they want. So it's definitely possible. The guy doesn't look Jewish, but he's certainly in with the Antifa. But So if we're going to talk about identity politics here, let's be real. The Cohens and the Burgers and the other people ranting about locking up Kyle Rittenhouse and throwing away the key, they're not worried about Black people. They're not that's just a proxy. This is Jewish payback. Shot three people and two of them. He shot three people were trying to kill him. He killed four people were trying to kill him. He killed two of them, and they were both Jews. At this point, that's all these Jews need to know for all reason and sanity to go completely out the window. And that's what I'm seeing, this frothing Jewish neurotic hatred all over Twitter.
Yeah, we're not, as Europeans, we're not really, we don't think like that. Like I was talking to some, I was talking to a guy who goes by the handle, the Jew function. Yeah. And he was saying that, he was saying a bunch of nonsense, but I pointed out to him that what you don't see in Gentile society is, for instance, the case of, oh, I forget his name now, but he was that Jewish convict in Texas who was convicted for beating a 16-month-year-old, or I'm sorry, a 16-month-old, to the point where I think several bones were fractured, his eye was bloodied, and then he was involved in a murder, I believe, and he got the death penalty, and 100 Jewish lawyers have all rushed to his defense because the judge supposedly said something anti-Semitic and racist at one point. You just don't see white people willing to engage in that kind of defense for somebody, one of ours, who's that vile. You just don't see that. And so, you know, the Rittenhouse thing and the case I just mentioned really tie into this idea that Jews might not be a monolith. They might not agree on everything, but what they all do agree on is that they're Jewish. And that it means something to be a Jew, and that no matter what, you have an obligation to your fellow Jew. And that's not necessarily an evil thing or a bad thing, but when you take that to the extreme that they do, you get these very weird behaviors like what we're seeing right now with the Rittenhouse case. Like, all objectivity goes out the window. You know, absolutely. It's just absolutely... Yeah.
They are so reaching with this Asian food thing. But this is basically the anatomy of every one of these PC scandals. Basically, somebody says something and some POC or POS pops up and pretends to be offended by it. They're not really offended. They're just pretending to be offended because they think they can get something out of it. And then the rest of the world pretends to give a shit about it and gives in to their whining. And we just ratchet ourselves one little click closer to complete social and moral and political chaos with these silly little games. Thomas, do you want to add something here?
Yes, I do. It all reminds me of this Yeats. I think it was by Yeats. And it was a poem about shouting towards Bethlehem, remarked that the worst of us are the most passionate and the best are the most dispassionate, or something very close to those lines, where the bad people are passionate, the good people are, you know, silent majority types.
Yeah. It's W.B. Yeats. It's called the Second Coming. I actually have an article about this, a Countercurrents. But yeah, he says the best lack all conviction, while the worst are filled with passionate intensity. And that kind of differential in psychological intensity, it will destroy any civilization. And that's what I was thinking of all through the year of George Floyd. The best, and by the best, I just mean the people on the public stage who stood for, you know, officially stood for law and order and stuff like that. The Republicans, right? The GOP, they had no conviction whatsoever. They were just waiting for this to blow over. They were just sort of nervously, you know, hands in their pockets, shuffling their feet, waiting for all this to blow over so they didn't have to say anything courageous. And because they were all passing the buck and waiting and being cowardly, this evil just went completely apeshit and destroyed many people's lives, many people's livelihoods, many cities are ruined because of this, because of the cowardice of the best and the passionate intensity of the worst. Jews are a people of passionate neuroticism. They're high-intensity people. you just can't have them in a society with laid back Aryan types, especially the more Nordic and, I think Jews have met their match with other people around the Mediterranean, right? The gesticulating Mediterranean in your face types, they could pretty much argue Jews to a standstill. It's the Nordics who want to avoid unpleasantness and don't want to talk about these things. They're the ones who are just not psychologically capable of allowing these people in their society because of the difference in psychological intensity means that these people are just going to constantly push. They're pushing and pushing and pushing their way into positions of power until they have the ability to completely debauch and destroy society. And guess what? We're already there. They have the keys. We're in the back.
They don't have any brakes.
And they don't have any brakes. They don't know how to put on the brakes, right?
And they have massive solidarity. Like I noticed that our types, they're too individualistic, especially the Nordics. And like if you look at this, the police department in Kenosha really should have gone on strike when that happened. I think given how blacks, part of my language will chimp out at the drop of a hat because a fentanyl addict died of an overdose. I'll be real. If white people, if Kyle is not exonerated completely, should go on strike. We should have gone on strike during Stop the Steal when Mike Pence betrayed everybody. And, you know, like I said in one of my articles, Justice Roberts was saying there weren't riots this time. Well, you know what? How about we give you no more food? The truckers go on strike. Now you're surrounded by angry, hungry black people. And you work there. We should have, black people will destruction. We can basically withhold our work. There will be no trucks running. The police will not work. We'll all walk out together. And we don't need to do anything. We don't do anything violent or illegal. We simply do not participate for a week. And we could bring them to our knees. But everyone's too individualistic. But more importantly, our leaders are weak. They won't call the horn. Trump wants to file lawsuits and play patty cake and have expensive dinners. He could have wielded more power by calling a strike whenever he was unhappy than by all this chicanery he engaged in.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think the general strike is something that is a very, very useful idea, definitely. Let's check and see if there are more questions here at Entropy. Exocet has donated $20. Thank you very much. Mohammed Aryan has sent in 10 AUD, Australian dollars. Thank you very much. Speaking of video games and the subversive theme subtext, how does American Krogan see Max Payne? Wasn't the first part quite based and radically against the prevailing tendency? A white family man whose wife and child are massacred, bumps off druggies, and fights against a devilish clique. What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not super, super familiar with the Max Payne series. I mean, I'm superficially familiar with it. I would say that from what I know about it, that seems to be the case with a lot of franchises. They somewhat start out as, somewhat quote-unquote based. I mean, they're really just not as subversive. And they have some masculine archetypes and facets to them that later wokeness gets applied to. For example, in my case, with something I'm a little bit more familiar with, the Krogan start out in the original Mass Effect game as fairly patriarchal and masculine. They're this very tribal reptilian race of super masculine warriors. They really don't have any kind of sense of egalitarianism at all. But what you see as the series unfolds is that young gamers probably associated that Krogan archetype with a sense of masculinity. And what happens is the feminist writers and the social justice advocates and other people come in and they start to take over the industry. They take over the writing teams and they start to apply feminist or egalitarian themes to that masculine archetype. And in the case of the Krogan, they started to introduce themes of where the female Krogan stood in the Krogan society. And they started to push this real sense of, women were actually superior to male Krogan. And people will kind of eat that up because they've already associated that archetype with something masculine. And so they're hoodwinked into believing that, oh, well, it's very masculine to constantly defer to women because, they're smarter and stronger than us. So I don't know if that really answers the question, but that's kind of what comes to mind. I would suspect that as Max Payne, if it gets any new iterations, it's probably going to be just as woke as anything else is today.
Max Payne sort of sounds like Death Wish, the game, basically. Thomas, do you have any thoughts on this?
I unfortunately haven't played Max Payne, but I do see a similar thing like in the Warcraft franchise. So it started out as a strategy game, or just like you move units around, they fight. Then became an MMORPG where you role play a guy and you fight on a team with like 20 other people against bosses and all this. That's a quick summary of it all. It's a rabbit hole. But start out, you know, very fantasy orientated, masculine people, you know, nice, you know, aesthetic women like Jaina Proudmoore, the mage. And it was cool at first, but then it got subversive. And I think the subversion began actually during this one expansion for World of Warcraft, where I don't play this game anymore, just so we're clear here. It's gone really bad. And I'm more productive in my life now. But Garrosh Hellscream almost became like a parody of Trump. And this is back when Trump was based. So I'm not sure like if they did this on purpose, but people saw kind of stuff because he became an orc supremacist in so many other words. He wanted a horde that was, you know, dominated by the orcs because the horde was originally orcish. How dare they want a orcish supermajority? I even saw a copypasta talking about, you know, we have to expel the undead laborers or something. And all this other stuff. And surprise, surprise, the guy who's militaristic in tradition, honor, is not a hippie like his predecessor, the other orc. He nukes this island, this human island that was too close to his home base, his capital. And I think they were trying to say like, basically any type of like militarism or just segues into supremacy. From supremacy, you segue into like mass atrocity. Just felt like, you know, Trump is, I felt at the time they're saying Trump is going to be Hitler if he's not stopped.
And I just have to interject here.
And after that with like gender bender stuff and all this.
I just have to interject and say here to for normal Countercurrents listeners who are not familiar with any of this video game cultural milieu, all of this stuff sounds absolutely bonkers. I assume it sounds absolutely bonkers. But what I think people have to understand who aren't familiar with video games is that, again, this is the battleground. And it's not normal people who are interpreting all of this content in these weird ways. It's the social justice advocates and it's the political activists and whatnot. They have come into this industry that, you know, once upon a time in the late 90s, early 2000s, it was kind of just, you know, fairly normal sort of old school action film. Yeah, had an old school action film orientation, and they've taken over all of these things. Like, if you're familiar with how Lord of the Rings has been, you know, turned woke and paused recently, if you're familiar with what Amazon is supposedly going to be doing with their series, that's the same thing that's happened with a lot of video game intellectual properties and franchises. They started out as one thing, and then these activists have come in, and they've inserted all of these, like, you know, critical race theory and modern social justice thought paradigms into these otherwise fairly normal intellectual properties. So yeah, I just wanted to highlight that.
Okay, let's look at what we've been receiving here over at DLive in terms of tokens. Andrew King has donated a Ninjagini. That's very generous. Thank you. Bartleby has donated 2 ice cream. And we have a question here from Archie Bunker. Archie asks, what do we think about the U.S. Navy naming a ship after Harvey Milk? This is Radicus, Sveticus, Swedish rat. He says, what are you guys' opinion about the U.S. Navy giving one of their new ships the name Harvey Milk? Are you joking or is this true?
I think it might be true. Yeah,
it's totally true.
Oh, my God. Yeah, that's really
yeah.
It's hard to take this country seriously anymore. I mean, if they wanted to pick a homosexual, they could have picked somebody who was who was actually like military, in the military rather than Harvey Milk, who was this whiny, nebbishy, effeminate Jewish politician and also gay. But you know, Gus Van Sant's movie Milk, about Harvey Milk, is actually a rather interesting film. And it has some interesting sort of retail political lessons in it. And it's kind of useful in understanding how white advocates might normalize ourselves like gays did in the 1970s in California. So it's not an entirely bad movie. I've been trying to get Gregory Hood to watch it and write something about it for years, because he wrote a brilliant article on political lessons out of the Michael Collins film, which I think is an excellent film. But yeah, so we're going to have a ship named after Harvey Milk. That's America has become just a joke, just a global joke.
I think Frody Midyard is right insofar that he says that, you know, we're already in the collapse. You know, we have this tendency to, you know, view the collapse as being some kind of like actual collapse, like a la Mad Max. And that's just not going to happen. We're going to see, you know, we're kind of in a sort of dark age, you know, like we've already dipped into that. And if you look back at history, these kinds of declines and whatnot, they take place over the span of decades, if not hundreds of years. And that's what we're in right now. And that's why a lot of our guys, I think, we all have to convert ourselves to the mindset of like, we're in this for the rest of our lives. We're in this for the long haul. There's no sequence of events by which we're going to, take back power in the next, you know, three or four election cycles or whatever. This is a long-term battle that, you know, hopefully our grandkids or great grandkids will come out the other side healthy and prosperous.
Yeah, I agree. We have to do that, and we have to think in very, very long terms. This is why I've always loved Frank Herbert, because he thinks about how society would have to be to think in very, very long time horizons, and that's one of the interesting, very reactionary things about the Dune novels. So anyway, let's see if we have any more questions over at Entropy. Nothing yet. Okay, well, we've only talked about the first BioShock series or game, and we haven't talked about the second one that you've done a show on. So can you give people an overview of all the videos you've done at this
yeah,
point,
okay.
And what's to come on BioShock, because it's becoming like Wagner's Ring Cycle or something. It's a big, big project.
Well, the first game again is about this, you know, Ayn Rand themed objectivist dystopia, and you know, obviously it has all these, you know, Jewish undertones. There's a second game which I don't cover in the series, and I don't have any immediate plans to cover because the developer of it, Jordan Thomas, is a Gentile, and I think that when he developed the game from a fairly different perspective than Ken Levine. And so I think that falls under, you know, Kevin McDonald's model of, you know, culture of critique. You know, you have to look at who's developing what and what their intentions are. You know, the whole Boasian anthropology movement, you know, the Gentiles in that movement had very different motivations from the Jews in that movement. So the same sort of mindset applies here to the second game. The third game, BioShock Infinite, was developed by Ken Levine as well. And it's this take on white Christian America. Instead of an underwater, you know, utopia that becomes a dystopia, you go to a city in the sky that's constantly referred to as New Eden. And it's supposed to be based off of this, you know, racist Protestantism, but there are all sorts of ways in which Ken Levine, you know, portrays the founding fathers as like these Catholic type saints. And it's just like, okay, well, where did intercession go? But in the beginning of the game, in order to enter the city, you have to undergo ritual baptism. And it's from a very Jewish perspective. The player character voices all these hesitations about it, all these resentments. The priest who gives you the baptism, he has these glassy blue eyes. And as he's baptizing you, you have these drowning sound effects going on. So it's like that whole Jewish theme of, you know, being drowned by baptism. He says to the other members of his congregation or his flock, "Oh, I don't know, brothers and sisters. I don't think this one is quite clean yet." And you are proceeded to be drowned. You wake up outside of, you wake up at the base of these three statues of the founding of the most important founders of the United States, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and George Washington. So there's this weird theme of the Trinity there as well. And all of the NPCs around the statues are citing all of these weird sort of jingoistic reinterpretations of the American founding. And they're referring to all of the founding fathers in ways that are ahistorical. And there's sort of like this weird jingoistic chauvinist religion that this city, which is called Columbia, by the way, you know, and Columbia is this old Anglo reference to you know, Anglo America. And so, yeah, it's just the game takes you down the path of all these historical anti-white tropes. Like, you talk about Wounded Knee, you talk about the Boxer Rebellion, and the Boxer Rebellion is presented as this violent, violent movement from Americans who just blew up the entire city of Peking. They don't present the other side of any of these events. And ultimately, the game pits you against this founder of Columbia called Zachary Comstock, who I assert is based off of Anthony Comstock, who was he was basically a late 19th century, early 20th century anti-smut activist. He was a very religious man. He was against the widespread dissemination of pornography. And Ken Levine obviously has a burning hatred for this guy, and so do a lot of other writers. You are fighting against this guy because he's so evil, racist, and oppressive. And in the end of the game, you find out that you are actually that guy from a different dimension. And again, it's very, very convoluted. But you find out that you're that guy from a different dimension. And the conclusion the player is meant to draw is that in a world of infinite realities and infinite possibilities, because in this world of Bioshock, there are infinite realities and infinite possibilities, you are always going to make a decision such that non-whites are going to suffer, and that the only way for the rest of the world to live in peaceful harmony is for you to let your daughters from infinite realities at this baptismal font drown you at the point where you either accept or reject baptism. Because if you reject baptism, you go on to have your daughter, Anna DeWitt, and your last name, DeWitt, is actually Dutch, and it means the white. So think about that symbolism there. So if you don't accept baptism, you go on to be this guilt-ridden guy about you fought at Wounded Knee, and you're ridden with guilt about Wounded Knee, and you become a gambling addict, and you have this daughter, and then you sell your daughter to your alternate self, Zachary Comstock, who lives in this other dimension, who becomes this white nationalist because he accepted baptism. So again, no matter what you do, your decisions always lead to enabling white supremacy, you know, white nationalism and all this evil, evil stuff. And so you have to die. You have to take an active part in your destruction in order to save everybody else from yourself.
No, so. This is just a white liberalism game, basically. Okay. If you play a game that you can't win, you're a fool. And you know, that's a pretty good definition or a way of pointing, you know, pointing out who's a fool. A fool is a person who plays games he can't win. A fool is a person who picks battles that he can't win, who fights battles that he can't win. That's what fools do. And this is a game that white Gentiles can't win.
And he makes jokes about this. Ken Levine makes jokes about this. He makes references to the fact that as the player, there are numerous situations in which you don't have any choice. He breaks the fourth wall constantly with these sorts of references. And so he's laughing at you as the player.
Yeah, there is so much of the stuff in our culture that just strikes me as malevolent people humiliating others. I'm sorry, all this stuff about eating bugs, at back of that, there are simply devilish, malevolent people who get off on the denigration, the degradation of other people who go along with this stuff. Yes, yes, I'll eat the bugs for climate change. I'll eat the bugs for social justice, that kind of stuff. All of this stuff about, you know, you got to eat the bugs and live in the pod and you can't eat beef anymore. All of that's premised on we have to have equality with the third world, with Africa, with the teeming masses. And I just say, no, we're not going to have equality with these people. I don't want to equalize my life chances with these people. They're of less value than me. We just have to reject all that. But you know, they're pushing global egalitarian totalitarianism through climate change stuff, and it's just a giant power grab, and it's a giant ritual of humiliation and degradation of white people, because we're the only ones who fall for this stupid propaganda. We're the only ones tying our tubes and adopting cats. We're the only ones adopting Haitian babies and this kind of stuff, all because of climate change. We're the only ones who are contemplating eating insects to reduce our carbon footprint and all that kind of stuff. I think it's not just a power grab. It's also a form of sadistic humiliation of the people who go along with it.
I totally agree. And it's hard, as I consider myself to be a fairly rational, objective person. And so it's hard for me to really accept these things, these conclusions sometimes. But I mean, again, if you spend enough time looking at the evidence, it's just something, you know, I'm repeatedly convinced is the case. And it's very, very hard to accept that people can be sort of that juvenile, that sort of like that they would get some kind of satisfaction out of debasing society to that extent. Because I would never get that kind of satisfaction out of that. Like, I just don't think like that. And most of us, I don't think like that. Yet yeah. There are people in power who do think like that.
Yeah, yeah. There's this thing called duper's delight. There are pathological people who enjoy the power trip of duping other people and humiliating other people. I think a lot of these psyops are just when you get
trolling of a sort.
Yeah, it's trolling. People get pleasure out of trolling. It's sadism. There's a great deal of sadism. Look, most people in our circles believe that there is a stealthy genocide going on against white people. Well, if they're trying to make us cease to exist entirely, then they're capable. I mean, if they're capable of genocide, they're capable of all lesser crimes as well. And they're also capable of just degrading us and polluting our culture just for shits and giggles and money. They make ungodly amounts of money at this. Even if the stuff that they put out doesn't advance their agenda, they will keep putting this stuff out there simply for money and also just to hog space, because if they don't put their garbage out there, some enterprising goy might actually start producing good art or good games or good literature. And they not only want to pollute our minds, they also want to make impossible for anything better to pop up.
Yeah.
Thomas.
Yeah, you even see it with the Rittenhouse trial. There are people on Twitter saying very disgusting stuff about Kyle, where they're like, some liberal was caught, and I forgot the name, but it was a Jewish name, when he was breaking down and sobbing because he was having like a PTSD attack, recounting being attacked by these savages. And they said, oh, that's the face he's going to make when he's like in prison being raped. And that's just a Jewish delighting in a model citizen, a white Boy Scout, being humiliated because they aren't part of their new program. Like, they really do hate us. They hate, and they hate the best of us most, more than anything else.
Yeah, Kyle Rittenhouse is an exemplary young man. He doesn't realize that America is not his country. He feels attachment to it. He's public-spirited. He went out to try and help his community. And one of the things that reeks to high heaven about the people who were commenting on this, and even some people who are sympathetic to him and think that he's not guilty of anything and the case has gone to hell, For instance, Geraldo Rivera, who's a tribalist, he was on Fox News commenting on this. And he had this line that he shouldn't have been doing this. He shouldn't have gone out there. You know, people are saying he was out there looking for trouble. He shouldn't have been doing that. The implicit assumption is that no one is going to say that Rosenbaum and Grosskreutz shouldn't have been out on the street burning things down, right? The streets belong to Antifa. The streets belong to BLM. The streets don't belong to white people who want law and order. That's the implicit assumption there. He was up to no good by being out there trying to do good and get in the way of basically black nihilism and Jewish Antifa nihilism as well. And that's the way that civilizations perish, when the best lack all conviction and the worst are full of passion and intensity. When there's nobody opposing these people, society perishes. If you want to destroy a civilization, just make it illegal to arrest black people. They'll do all the rest. It's just a matter of time. The fury and rage at this young man is really something to behold. It's really unhinged. Why is that? Because these people know that there are more guns in America than there are people. That 80% of the guns in America are owned by people like Kyle Rittenhouse. And that the next time there's a race war in America, those people might get their guns out. And then things are going to go very, very differently for them. And so they have to make an example of this kid. They have to destroy this kid, because they won't get their way. They won't be able to riot and loot and burn and defile if white people finally get their guns out. Then it's going to be a very, very different ending. So they've got to destroy this kid. And they tried their best. But the thing is that the left, they're not very formidable. This prosecutor is a dope. You're right. He's one of these midwits who believes his own bullshit and thinks that, you know, everyone's going to go along with it because they want virtue points, virtue signal points, and props on Twitter from Jews and dullards. And it's falling apart. It fell apart. I'm really looking forward to the closing statements next week.
Me too. I think it's just like a very cringe version of the Turner Diaries, where they know they can't do a gun grab, so they want to make the right of self-defense taboo, at least for white people. But I think it's going to backfire, because eventually it's going to collapse. I think we're going to win bigly in this case. And they just, like, open everyone's eyes to, like, what horrible people they are.
It's interesting you brought the Turner Diaries, because I think Ken Levine in Bioshock Infinite sort of, in some ways, was thinking about the Turner Diaries. Because there's this constant theme of New York in Bioshock Infinite being the Sodom below. That's what they constantly refer to the world outside of the Protestant ethnostate Columbia. It's all the Sodom below. New York is target numero uno in the white Christian Protestant genocidal war against the other world that this game posits is inevitable. And people, I remember there was this person who contacted me after I finished my Bioshock series, and they said, well, because I end with a quote from William Luther Pierce, and they were like, well, you're telling everybody that actually that Ken Levine is right, that this is inevitably what white nationalism leads to, it, this genocide of New York, this blowing up of New York. And what people don't remember is that William Luther Pierce, despite what you think about his more edgy statements, he was responding to a concerted mediatic and cultural and political movement against us. He didn't ever really advocate the idea of just like spontaneously going out into the rest of the world and killing everybody. And so people, I can see how they could get hoodwinked by that sort of interpretation that, Ken Levine is right, that ultimately if white people are allowed to go their own way, you know, they're going to kill everybody. And I mean, and that's the moral framework or the perspective Ken Levine is presenting to everybody. If white people are allowed just basic sovereignty, they're going to go and genocide everybody because they view everybody outside of their ethnic sphere or their racial sphere as the Sodom below. And it's just there's ridiculous.
There's one of those ghoul cartoons where, you know, the little stick figure says, "I'm concerned about the future of my people." And the other stick figure says, "Help, he's going to kill everybody." It's so damn ludicrous. But this is the level on which these game messages are pitched. Thomas?
Yeah. So this actually came up at the Charlottesville trial too, where we had this, some of these experts, it's hard to keep track of because they all are of the tribe. They're all Jews, but one of them, like Pete Simi, I think he's the one leading the charge on basically saying that any type of white advocacy is always violent. And oh my goodness, he just ended up, like, I think, committing perjury and making a fool of himself. But it's the same thing going on in Charlottesville as in BioShock and in Kenosha. And I'll just say this, some people on the right are not covering Charlottesville, and they are not even covering Rittenhouse. I think those people are silly because we're on this together. They are the next targets of this, like, weird Patriot Purge witch hunt. Like, people like Sean Hannity, I don't think they realize how close they are to being targeted next for anarcho-tyranny.
Well, it's interesting because in the latest Call of Duty Vanguard game that's all about World War II, there's this trailer for one of the online multiplayer characters that you play, and she's this Indian woman with a shotgun, and she's, I assume that the scene takes place in India, and it's bizarre because they're fighting Nazis in India, and I'm not aware of any German occupation of India during World War II. But
might have been with their esoteric research.
I'm sorry?
They were into esoteric research regarding ancient Indo-European stuff, so maybe that's the hook.
I don't think that's the stance they were taking. This is sort of like they depict the Germans as being colonialist, imperialist occupiers of India, and she's fighting back against the colonialist invaders alongside the British soldiers, which is bizarre because, you know, it was, you know, Britain who colonized India, not Germany. And so she's murdering all of these Germans. Like, there are even Germans surrendering, and she's just blowing them away with a shotgun. And in the end, she hands a knife to a white British bloke who then proceeds to stab to death a German soldier who had surrendered. Again, it's just very, very bizarre stuff. The point was that British bloke and any British person watching that trailer and thinking that, oh yeah, Britain's on the side of anti-racism and we're morally righteous and right. No, you're next. That British guy with the knife, you're next, buddy. You know, you will not be spared for killing your brothers or demonizing or vilifying your brothers. You will be next.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a Ninja Genie from Alaska Chaga. Thank you very much. We also have a gift and comment over here from Unknown Californian, who sends $5. My second child was born earlier this week. We just got home from the hospital yesterday. It's a joyous occasion. However, a dark cloud looms on the horizon and is quickly approaching. My employer wants me vaxxed. I could be unemployed by January or February. Well, the Fifth Circuit Court, I guess it is, has upheld a stay against these vax mandates on fairly solid grounds. So I would hang in there, frankly. If you don't want to get this done, you might not have to. And I would also investigate religious exemptions and things like that. I think that there are ways of dealing with this. You might lawyer up. I know a good lawyer in California, a freshly minted lawyer in California you might want to get in touch with. So anyway, there are ways of handling this, but good luck to you. And thank you for your donations. And you've been very generous for ages. I hope you catch the replay of this because I know you tuned in late and are regretting that you missed out on this gaming discussion. So folks, let's wrap up here. We've been going for more than 2 hours. We have been talking primarily about American Krogan's series on BioShock. And if you look at the bottom of the screen, scrolling across there is his link tree. He has videos on BitChute and also on Odyssey, is that correct?
Yes.
And he's been doing gaming videos, and he educated himself in public, became increasingly red-pilled, and has been doing I think, really high level analysis and also very entertaining analysis of racial and Jewish ethnic themes in a lot of popular games. And I think it's a very important task. So tell us a little bit about what's coming from you.
Oh boy. So I have two videos that I'm working on at the moment. One is about the newest Far Cry installment from Ubisoft, Far Cry 6. It takes place on a fictional Caribbean island nation called Yara. It's basically a loose analog for Cuba. It takes place in the year 2021, and it's basically about a sort of gay communist overthrow of a fascist, quote-unquote, dictator. And it has all these, like, really weird, inconsistent ideas. Like, again, like, over half the combatants are women. There's the second in command of the fascist military is a woman. Yet there are all these themes about the transgender community being super oppressed. Yet, you know, again, the fascist regime seems quite progressive considering how many women are in these prominent roles. So it's just kind of hard to swallow. So I'm going to be doing a video on that. I'm also going to be doing a video on the most recent Call of Duty Vanguard, which is about World War II. There are direct references to the Rhineland occupation after World War I. There's a black troop who basically, he goads a Nazi commander who has taken him prisoner. He explains to this Nazi commander, oh, your Rhineland accent makes me think about how people who look like me occupied your homeland and married your women. So he does that whole thing. The game does all of that. So I'm probably going to talk about the Rhineland occupation and the data I have on that. Probably some other Call of Duty games are going to tie into that as well, because there's, like, in the 2019 game, Call of Duty Modern Warfare, there's a whole lot of, you know, Russia phobia, anti-Russia neocon propaganda that's going to tie into everything. So I'll be doing two videos on that. I've been talking to some people in our movement about doing a documentary on the decline of America. I don't have anything solidified for that yet, but, you know, in the next year, that might be a thing. So that's really the major work that's to come so far.
Well, that is excellent news. Thomas Steuben writes for Countercurrents. You can follow him at Countercurrents. I want to thank both of you for coming on. I want to thank our moderators. I want to thank our donors. I want to thank all the listeners out there. And there's just so much here to talk about. I'd love to have you come back again soon. I think this has been a really enjoyable stream. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio. I'm going to be talking with a number of friends who are today enjoying the American Renaissance Conference in Tennessee. And they're going to be coming on. I hope Gadius Maximus will come on. I hope Bitcoin Carl will come on. Rich Hauck. I'm going to try and get three or four people who are at the conference to come on the stream. And tomorrow, we have the writer's block. The writer's block starts an hour later than Countercurrents Radio. It starts at 1 o'clock Pacific time, 4 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And whatever, you know, do the math if you're in Europe. And the guest that Nick Gielvi will be having is Joel Davis, and he's going to be talking about the post left. And basically, Joel has been dunking on Amy Therese. Amy has undergone some interesting intellectual changes recently, from a Marxist to somebody she's calling she's calling herself a post-leftist, and she's sort of become a neocon, or not a neocon, but she's embracing colorblind civic nationalism and speaking as somebody who's sympathetic to the right now. So this is an interesting development, and they're going to talk about that. And of course, current events and your questions. So tune in, same channel, slightly different time tomorrow for the writer's block. And thank you again, Krogan, for being on. Thank you, Thomas, for helping out. And we will be back next week with another episode of Countercurrents Radio.